Welcome to season 4 of Conscious Conversations. This season is titled The Educational Experience as Self-Knowledge. We explore learning not merely as instruction, but as a sacred embodied practice, a way of becoming, transforming, and returning to ourselves. I am your host, Mabato Monze, a spiritual practitioner, independent transdisciplinary researcher, and spherical guide. My work is rooted in Africana womanist ecometaphysics and grounded in indigenous knowledge systems. This podcast is an offering, a living archive of memory and possibility. Together with teachers, artists, visionaries, and cultural workers, we enter conversation as ritual, as recovery, and as reimagining. Welcome.
Hi, Mbato. I am, before I even give you my name, I want to say that I'm standing here on Earth, on the Chumash lands in Santa Barbara, California, and joining you at around 10 a.m. Pacific time. My name is Monica Modi, Dr. Monica Modi, and I come from India, so I'm not from this land. I have been asked to be here on this land, on this earth here right now for a few different reasons. And part of the reason is that we needed to have a conversation, right? So this is what we're doing. So I'm looking forward to what we're going to be doing here today in this space together. As we were saying just before we started recording, I have no idea what we're going to be talking about, but I'm trusting that the space that we're opening up here is witnessed and supported by the ancestors and by the Kuntumli and by all kinds of supportive energies that want us to be talking right now. So I am really looking forward to this conversation.
So your presences are definitely felt. Firstly, thank you so much for making or setting aside the time for us to have this conversation. I really appreciate having crossed paths with you, and I do hope that it is a journey that will continue to take its own course and hopefully be a catalyst for really doing or strengthening the work of the remembering of the feminine, the matriarch, across the globe. I am particularly reminded of an elder, I'll call her an elder, Kogi Naidu. She's in her 60s, an Indian woman who has been a teacher in my life and a healer. She is one of the people I would say helped me to connect to my own spirituality because of the stigma that existed around African spirituality specifically, and some of the groundwork I had to do in remembering, who I am, but the important work Indian people or spirits have had in my own journey. So I'd really love to honor that and to also recognize, I think, the marginalization of Indian women and how that is often not spoken about. Yeah, and thank you for being a part of the Conscious Conversations community. Sure.
Yeah. Can I just say this is, I didn't know this piece about your story, and hearing this is just making me, you know, well up, because I would say that in my own spiritual journey, metaphysical journey, a big role was played by my being able to sit with the teachings from Dagara, Burkina Faso, that Dr. Mala Damasume was bringing to the West, and Sabon Fusame was bringing to the West. And, you know, I've had a chance to sit with many wisdom keepers, but I would say that it's African spirituality as it came to the West, you know, via these elders, that was able to, in some ways, be the link that could reconnect me to my own ancestral heritage, ancestral teachings. Because, yeah, the word stigma you used, I mean, there's, I mean, it's, the history has been different in India, but, you know, maybe there's a common element, which is that of colonization. And yeah, so it's in India, in South Asia, similarly, as I was growing up, in, you know, post-colonial, secular India, it wasn't considered to be reasonable or rational to be engaging in spirituality. And, you know, there's, I'm not at all, you know, a believer that if something is given to us as religious code, religious behavior, religious precept, that we need to follow it, you know, absolutely not. So yeah, I still, you know, have my own way of entering into some of those conversations, and also, you know, forming a relationship with some of those energies and entities, right, from within my own ancestral context. But yeah, I have such deep gratitude for the fact that I was able to, you know, be in community with the elders, and also, you know, the people who came around the elders, allowing myself to be able to step into ritual in a very deep way, in a very real way, into earth-based seeing in a very real way. So this is a beautiful parallel. I just wanted to name that.
Thank you so much for that. And I think it really just speaks to the interconnected nature of our stories, right? And the need to, especially right now, to be talking about our stories, because there is just so much, you know, that can emerge from them, whether it is from an academic perspective to a healing perspective, which are often components of our lives that are separated, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do we begin to draw on the lived experience together with our spiritual selves to transform the world we find ourselves in? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, again, like, really, I want to, like, honor how I think I've been known you for over a year now, Bato, right? And yeah, just through different formats of conversations, the ways in which you have been enacting exactly what you speak of, putting into practice exactly what you speak of. So I want to see that and, you know, acknowledge that you're doing that. And I think this still remains work that is difficult, that still remains work that is risky to do in academia, right? Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like I definitely took an unconventional academic path. I definitely chose to move into, you know, that interface that you're talking about, right? Like, it's an interface that does not make a separation between the realm of the personal, the realm of the political, the realm of community, the realm of spirituality, right? Like all of it is here, like in the mix, right? And for me, the path forward became a way of figuring out how all of these can be in conversation together, right? And I also went deep diving into rabbit holes, which would probably be frowned upon by, you know, more mainstream academic ways of understanding what knowledge is, what scholarship is. And at the same time, you know, I'm also aware, right, like that there are these, it's almost as though, you know, we have these images of what an academic should look like, right? And who can be a scholar and how is it permitted to be a scholar, right? I think for me, it's useful to be aware of them and to engage with them in the way that Homi Bhabha called it double vision. And then there is this whole notion of, you know, the trickster, right? I see as enabling me to tap into some of those codes and ways of speaking that allow me to be legible, right? Like to those powers, right? Like those ways in which, you know, those communication discourses have been organized. But it doesn't mean that I buy into them, right? But it's sort of like me learning the language, right? Like to be able to make the bridge. But also, I don't always want to make that bridge. Because the harsh thing is that in under coloniality, the effort to make that bridge and to be translatable usually falls upon those of us who are wanting to step outside mainstream academia, right? Like, and really are hoping to, again, you know, connect with all these different domains which are cut off on a more conventional scholarly path. So yeah, I think I think there's you know, and I just want to again like connect it to a very, very old way of understanding knowledge. Knowledge was not meant to be specialized and cut off in this way, right? If you're calling back, tapping into, you know, our old indigenous selves, right? Like all of us that really like stand here connected to the earth, then we need to be looking at the earth as a whole and we need to be feeling her as a whole, right? Like, and we need to be able to, again, calling on all of her as we're contributing, how we are understanding ourselves and our relationships and each other and, you know, what we are here to do on earth and how we are here to dance on earth, all of those things. And then, you know, I'm also aware of the paradox that I am teaching within a university, right? Which means that I have specific courses, right? So I bring in a transdisciplinary orientation, which means that I'm really able to like, you know, I want us to, you know, not forget that there is some kind of a unified understanding of knowledge. And again, the absolutely lived experiences and stories are like a real, really crucial part of it, right? Because we're not making knowledge in a vacuum. Knowledge is relational, right? Like, and it's also, and again, like the metaphysically, what's getting activated in me is being sparked by what it is that I'm here on earth to learn at this time. And what is getting sparked in you is maybe different, right? So The reason, so I think there's a, it's not just about the political decolonial aspect, or like a political decolonial aspect that's only about countering the fragmentation of knowledge, because in colonial renderings of academia, knowledge has been fragmented, right? Absolutely, we need to be able to speak of and from where we stand upon the earth, where we stand in our lives, where, how we see the see our story, and all the ways in which we have become who we have become as a result of our experiences. We need to be able to speak to that in as a political to decolonize politically knowledge. But the deeper level of decolonization and decolonial work really is that this is because we're talking about knowledge as liberation, like, and liberation as, again, political, spiritual, what recognizes that we're essentially here to again be reflections of this incredible welling life force, right? Like, that's what you're here to be, and we have to be sovereign in our expressions. We have to have, a connection to the unique way in which we bring our gifts into the world. So that uniqueness, that absolute, utterly irreplicable uniqueness, is why, we need, like, our stories matter so much, right? And yeah, like, not just at the level of narrative, at, as how Western narratology understands this, but story as something that's so powerful. So story as something that is so sacred, story that's really connected to the living story of the earth, right? Like, in a living story that's always being, like, it's continually, it's happening all around us. It's happening all around us. Even now, I'm like, whoa, like, where are the, what are the fishes saying? What are the leaves saying? What is that one little tender? It's like, it's such a powerful living story. And, like, that movement of story within that is our story. And as our story moves, we can impact the story of the earth.
Sure, the level of depth in what you have shared, and I think my own really allowing myself to be nurtured by your articulation of your understanding of your journey, because it reflects so much of how I experience myself in so many ways, so it feels so affirming to hear you share in those very specific words. And yet it also brings a wealth of I guess questions, not that I would be assuming that we've got the answers, but really to help us reflect on this particular human experience, right? And I think particularly for us who have incarnated in female bodies, with the various categories that have marked our bodily experience, right? And understanding that even just the awareness, that high level awareness of what has happened or what is happening with humanity, with human beings, and the choice we have to participate in the telling of a story, is such a privilege, considering what education is. So it is a privilege. It has also, for me, it also feels niche when one considers everyday people, especially people who are or who feel, who perceive themselves as oppressed by colonialism, right? Because I think there's a particular awareness around what is happening that helps one to either be dragged by it or that motivates one into a process of self-knowledge. You know, you spoke about knowledge being so important, right? And as ancient spiritualities, histories have spoken, you know, that internal teacher that Swami spoke about, right? Know thyself, that ancient Egypt spoke about, right? And how that fits into the very categories of the human experience that has been removed from the mysteries of life, right? And so as a feminine who has awakened, or as a feminine body who has awakened to this mystery, you know, there being, I've been reading about faith and philosophy, religion, theology, and how African spirituality especially was categorized as magic, but magic in its most lowest form, right? And just thinking about the ability to create across the different disciplines you work in. I mean, you are a multiple published author. You continue to grow in terms of institution. Your spiritual life, you know, is also expansive. So there's a magic in that. There's a mystery in being able to hold the tension without necessarily collapsing into one neat story, right? There's all these identities that exist, and being able to honor that, including rest, because it does take a toll on the body. You know that I'm doing research on epigenetics, and so healing at a metaphysical level does have an impact on the body. You know, so being able to deal with some of the very deep-rooted pain that comes with remembering and grieving.
I think first of all, I want to say, like, in this birth, it is such a privilege to be born a woman. It really is. And you know, when I was in my early 20s, I lived in Delhi, and I was part of, I was working in a feminist legal research organization and a part of a queer feminist collective, and, you know, and very androgynous in my appearance in some ways. And, you know, I really honor, like, all that I learned about, you know, power in that time. And I think it was few years later when I kind of, like, really started connecting with the mysteries of life, and as they moved through and revealed through my body, right, in this body, this, that, I think there was another such an incredible layer opened up, right? Like just the connection between the womb and the void, as in feminist gynocentric thought, right? Like the idea of where it's all come to end, where it all begins. And yeah, there is such a profound mystery there, just to kind of, like, not just contemplate in an abstract way, but to kind of really sense it through your body, right? And the, you know, the mystery of form and formlessness. And so I think, you know, there's so much there that I want to just again honor this embodied experience that creates a one window into that. And so I think for many of our ancestors when they hear how these ways of understanding ourselves in the cosmos came to be so denigrated and dismissed under colonization, right? Like primitive, savage, magic, right? Like not just like you were saying, the lowest form of magic. I mean, they're either laughing or they're furious, right? Because the way, the ways of understanding self and cosmos that have come to us via these paths, which tend to be fragmented or patriarchalized, or, you know, interpreted by European interpreters and all of those things. You know, a lot of the times there's so much misinformation there, and yeah, things have been erased or cut off. But like what's come down to us is so profound, that awareness of cosmos and self. And it's also not lost. So I think this is kind of like the profound decolonial puzzle, how to acknowledge what got erased or fragmented or marginalized or lost during colonization, and also kind of remember that we have the capacities to be able to tap into it. Mm-hmm. And that's the paradox, right? And you know, the pain of remembering is, and the grief is absolutely like a crucial part of that, right? Like, and again, this is a spiraling journey, right? So it's not as though you do it once and then it's over. I wrote my dissertation, that's it. I am some kind of Sidh. I never have to walk this again. No, I have things happening in my life right now, which are kind of really asking me, am I continuing to walk on this path of, you know, the remembering, retrieving what was forgotten, right? What they would rather I forget, right? We forget. Mm-hmm. But there's another piece to that, and I want to really name that because it's up for me right now. You know, these forces of colonialism are not in the past. Mm-hmm. They're also right here. They're very much part of our present, right? Like in the sense that I'm not even going to speak about what's happening in different parts of the world right now. And like, but yes, what is happening in Palestine? What is happening in Kashmir? What is happening, you know, here in the US as these ICE raids take place? What's happening in different parts of Africa, right? Like Congo, Sudan, you know, this is just like we're naming these without forgetting that, like, that, like what I really want to speak to is that, like, narrative, colonial narrative, which is kind of still very much in play right now, which wants us to give a power over to these larger forces, which often today are connected with technological surveillance. And, you know, this also not just surveillance, it's like a technologization again, there's a way in which our lives themselves are, they're wanting to, like, kind of like take the flow of our lives and fit it within algorithms, right? So and so in that way, it's right here. Like, we have this beautiful laptop and Zoom and all of these technologies, but also the ways in which these technologies are very much, much connected to these, you know, discourses. So I want to name that, you know, this work of remembering needs to happen when there's so much in some ways that really wants us to kind of veer away from, you know, work we may have begun, right? Or work we want to do, right? But then, I think I think the trick will be to remember that there's something very gritty and stubborn inside of us, right? And again, it's not just us, it's also our ancestors. And so we can always swim and find our way back. We're talking about water earlier, right? Like that's like water. This is about kind of really like that potent force of water to really yeah, though there's ways in which the entire landscape can be transformed, right? It's not about quantity, right? Like it's not a quantitative thing that I'm referring to. I'm really talking about a way of seeing, right? Like it's these invisible connections that we need to begin to see, and not only, you know, with all the forces of nature, of you know, spirit that are supporting us, but with each other. And so that work requires dedication. It requires, you know, being able to remember again and again that this work is possible. So I think, like, I think, you know, for me, the grief sometimes comes at this point, and you know, there was like maybe other things that earlier, but now, right now, I'm like, how did we let this happen? Right? How did we allow the world to kind of like get to this place, really? Where, you know, for some people, it feels like there's no solution in sight, right? Like, you know, there's all these collapse narratives, and I find it. Yeah, so I think there's so much grief there, and then also, you know, something that I think I've heard many, many elders say, like we're here for a reason. So, you know, there's like without even focusing too much on the why, I want to come back to what's possible now, what's possible in this moment, right? And how do we even like turn every moment of engagement into that precise alive moment of contact, right? Because of course there will be time where, you know, I don't know, I have to like fill out a spreadsheet, you know, where I have to kind of like focus into that. But the question is like, how do I kind of like come back out of that mode of, you know, narrow mode of being again and again? And how do I connect to the roots of the tree again and again? And how do I kind of like remember, you know, that access that moves within me, that connects me to the earth and to the sky and, you know, everything. So, yeah, I think I just want to name that, you know, like colonization is not in the past. We're kind of like really in a moment, in a very interesting moment in history where, you know, when I first started doing my own work of ancestral remembering, decolonial remembering, I felt like maybe I was one of the early people. Maybe I didn't know that, you know, that many people wanting to do the work. So I feel like I was doing this work, you know, in a different way. And now, I see a lot more people wanting to walk on this path, and I just want them to remember that this is more important than ever. This work is more important than ever because there's so much, you know, the propaganda about, like, you know, and there's all these discourses right now, right, which will try to distract us or capture our attention or try to tell us that, yeah. Like you can go this far, but no far, or you know, they'll try to misdirect us. And so I think really being able to tap into, you know, the way in which our feet are connected to the earth and our hearts are connected and you know, to the hearts of our ancestors. I think like yeah, and kind of like sensing into that, you know, knowing that this work is always happening and we can always find our way back. I think it's more crucial than ever. So I have no idea if I, you know, addressed anything you wanted me to or you were bringing up, but hopefully there was some meat.
A lot again. I mean, from the double vision that you started speaking about, and I think for me, it speaks to having the capacity to self-create in the very institutionalized academic colonial space. That has a lot to do with self-determination as well, because we do live in this particular reality. It has not collapsed as yet. It's on its way there, but it has not collapsed as well. And so in order to be impactful in the work, we need to be able to operate with this double awareness, consciousness, you know, even if I may. Some people also call it the two-eyed seeing approach in integrative sort of like approaches in psychology. And then you're speaking to colonization as a very broad concept. It's so apt because, as you know, I've been tracing my maternal journey with having gone to Botswana on my maternal ancestral pilgrimage and seeing what colonization, ongoing colonialism, and how they are different in terms of how they manifest themselves. People speak about post-coloniality, but we are still living in ongoing colonialism, right? You look at a country like Botswana, where my great-grandmother comes from. It has had its independence as a democracy for 60 years now, but the Basawa people, the indigenous hunter-gatherer people, are subjected to exactly what we are talking about when we're speaking about epistemological erasure, right? It is ongoing. On top of that, the leadership of the country is Black. It has had its independence for 60 years. So then questions around what democracy means, particularly in colonized countries, means, you know, I've been thinking about development as a concept. How does the Global South consider itself in connection to what development actually means, considering how development as a concept is hinged to democracy, which is also hinged to the support of structural or imperialism as a concept, you know, and as an ongoing process of colonialism, you know, in Africa as an example, or the Global South. And to also bring your own creative work into this, because it is a part of that healing that takes place as you are doing the intellectual work that often Western paradigms remove from theory as a practice, right? So being able to integrate theory or your intellectual activism, you are a creative in various forms, from poetry to being a published author. How do you find your own journey of transformation? Because it, for me at least, it goes back to also healing as an individual from my own colonization, right? And how that is reflected back into the work that I do, and the process of healing that. It manifests in different ways. One is triggered by different things, whether it's systemic exclusion, as an example, for someone like me, pursuing this doctoral degree and not necessarily being able to easily do it because of economic exclusion, and because the kind of field I'm in or the work I'm pursuing is so transdisciplinary, and access to institutions that have got the capacity to hold something like that at a creative level, even that becomes challenging. So it becomes communal work as well, right? But in your own journey, as a creative, as an intellectual, as a woman of color, indigenous woman all these different identities, how does your creative process work? How is it informed by your healing?
With deep gratitude to Mtutu Ndebele, his Indumba EP not only invites ancestral presence, but it also awakens the spirit. Kamaku.
Yeah. I mean, the just to pick up and riff very, very briefly on the theme of development and progress. And yeah, it's so pervasive, right? I think, like, you know, this, I just want to say, like, we've, I think, collectively in the post-colonial moment, we seem to have really bought into these, you know, very, very colonial ideas about development and progress, which have nothing often to do with the sacred and to our capacity to tap into the sacred, but not in, you know, not in a way that's serving the vested powers that be, you know, not in a way that's serving people who are in hierarchy, right? Or beings who are in hierarchy, but really serving, again, the imperative of, you know, the deep evolutionary longing that I think is, you know, within our own DNA, right? Like it's within, you know, our own makeup. So, yeah, I think it would be fascinating if, as we begin to maybe think about, I don't want to keep, you know, overusing this term, right? But, you know, just, I mean it, like, here, decolonized development discourses, right? Like, what would that look like? And it's, I think, it is something that will change, I think, how the struggles happen amongst many indigenous communities. And I hope, or maybe it's going to, you know, it's going to arise from there, and it's going to affect the discourses. But I think it's needed because, yeah, we need to, as a collective, as a human collective, start thinking of alternatives beyond survival, right? Like, so we need to start doing that. Yeah. And so I identified myself as a poet long before I identified myself as a scholar. When I started my PhD, I had already, you know, been writing poetry for a long time and had published one book and already. And in fact, I resisted learning some of the, you know, norms of scholarship because I was like so caught up in being a rebel poet. I was like, no, I'm a poet. I can do anything, right? And then I realized that, oops, nope, the, you know, especially the white male scholars who are kind of like sitting in the corridors of academia are really not going to let me pass through unless I've, you know, figured out how to speak their language. So that lesson learned, you know, I kind of moved and yeah, I think I was like, okay, fine, poetry, I won't deal with you for a bit. But then what happened as I started doing my doctoral work, my doctoral research, was that it became so clear that I had to think in different ways. I had to allow language to move through different ways, move through me in different ways, right? Because this substance, language, breath, connected to, you know, again, our spirit, our willpower, but also connected to collective norms that organize words and grammar and protocols, all of those linguistic protocols, all of those things, right? I feel like it was clear that there was something I could do by allowing language to kind of really, you know, encounter me in the form of poetry, that allowed me to call upon ancestral knowing, ancestral knowledge in a different way. So I wasn't thinking of it in terms of healing at the time. You know, of course, healing has to happen when you're, you know, I think, thinking about broadening knowledge in that way. But for me, this was really about being able to connect with the ancestors and connect with my mother line and connect with my grandmother and, you know, the feminine line and lineage and things like that. So, and it became clear, you know, there were these two different modes of writing and that they were in conversation with each other. And since then, also, when I'm writing, it's clear to me, you know, if I'm writing an academic essay, sometimes it's absolutely clear to me that this needs to be written in the form of a poem also, or in the form of a poem first. So it's about like really understanding, I think, you know, that something like, you know, we, and I'm only speaking for myself, and I think there's some incredible scholars out there for whom this may not be the path, right? Like, but for me, given who I am and given my own path, often, and you know, even when I'm speaking to you, I'm not just speaking because you can hold it, we can do this. I'm not just speaking in scholarly terms with you. I'm really bringing in, you know, like a broader, more expansive understanding of knowing and cosmos and learning and ourselves, right? And so it's often still the case that academic language cannot purely hold those things. So for me, poetry becomes a way to speak. And it's a language that still, there's so much ambiguity around poetry still, right? Like it's not, it doesn't have to satisfy some of the same demands of coherence and rationality and make it make sense, you know, all of those things that I can do that. You know, I can like kind of like, so allow, poetry can, to kind of like tap into these other things that I'm sensing. And the key thing, of course, is the making contact and the sensing myself. Mm-hmm. And that's where, I guess, you know, what the connections that had been sleeping within myself or within my own knowing begin to wake up, mm-hmm. right? And I begin to, you know, like really start awakening in a very fresh way to these relationships, mm-hmm. right? That's what it is. Like, so for me, you know, it's a beautiful technology. And I know for, you know, for some artists, they may have other things. I'm also a dancer, mm-hmm. you know, so for me, you know, dance for me is more about like internal work. It's been several years since I've performed in public, and I don't think I'm at a point where I want to teach dance, because it's, for me, it's so important to hold that as a sacred space. But there's something about, again, this like embodied, non-cognitive, non-linear way of being able to connect with everything, everyone who's wanting to connect with us. That's the role of art, like, right? Like an art, again, not as a small thing, but art as this immense thing, this immense stream of knowing, right? Like language that allows this immense stream of knowing to kind of like move through us. So I think, I really think there's, like, for me, it's so integral to my scholarly path, you know. I would be a far poorer scholar if I didn't have, you know, these ways of knowing and speaking and articulating, kind of like really nourishing my understanding of epistemology. And I think we, like, again, This is, again, this is, goes back to that holistic, interconnected way of being human.
Oh, right. And I connect to so much, like everything that you're saying, but also very much aware of the time we have together and that self-care. But I mean, the ability to, so first of all, I recognize in my own writing, right, some of the thinkers, creators, activists, change makers who have come to me through writing. And I look at some of my own like musical influences, from Tracy Chapman, for example, to someone like Tupac, as an example. So you spoke about grit earlier. I was thinking about Tupac and rap as a genre and how back then, I mean, you look at Lauryn Hill as well, people like that influence the consciousness of the arts, right? Through music that was very relevant to the politics of that time, but also to their own sense of awareness of who they were and these different identities they were carrying, right? And translated that into creative work. And just how visceral, so how tangible, how raw the process of going through that internalization, inner reflection of what is going on in you, and you know, having the ability to have it as creative output, right? So that is a process on its own that I think, precisely because maybe the academic space does not have the language to hold it, makes it difficult for people who go through the decolonial journey to, like, personally to be in the academic space as well. You spoke about risk earlier. So the risky part then comes here, where to have the capacity to hold, you know, in my own work, I call it relational coherence. It's not perfect, right? It shows up in different forms, in different ways, in different spaces. But having the capacity and the integrity, right, ongoing ethics to be with it as it is emerging, and still to create it according to your own standard of how you want your work, your art form to be, you know, which is, I think, the academic rigor for me, at least as a person growing up in Africa, the intellectual or the Western frame has helped me hone certain skills in particular ways. And I think often in the conversations around decoloniality, we do not speak about this double vision that also says, hey, Western ideology or how their sciences have also brought us the ability to write in specific ways, to track our history, to rewrite, you know, all of these things which were not a part of our oral traditions, which I think are valuable, you know. So these are just some of my own reflections, but I do know that our time is up. And so I appreciate you still being here. Any closing reflections? Really, it's a huge conversation.
Huge conversation. And I know that we'll have many, many more conversations in the future. I think this was just so many incredible, we could go in many incredible directions, but I think I want to just like be here with you for a second and just want to acknowledge, you know, you opening up this space and inviting us to kind of like sit together and have this conversation together today for a bit. And yeah, I'm looking forward to connecting with you, you know, in other ways, and we'll be in touch, Mbato. So thank you, everyone. Yeah, you know, just remember, we are all incredibly powerful. Like, that's like just like just like let your roots go down into the earth, to the core of the earth, and kind of like really touch, you know, that living, pulsing energy right there at the center of the earth, and allow it to like move through you. Remember how, again, remember, like we don't have to know all the answers and the solutions right away. But yeah, let's just kind of like allow that movement to happen through us, because, you know, the story has not been written. We're not at the end yet, right? Like, so we're very much a part of the co-writing, co-creating the story that is being told. So let's not lose hope. Let's, in fact, again, kind of like really imbue the word hope with such pulsing potential. Like it's a living word, right? Like it's a living word. So with that, thank you, Bato.
Thank you so much, Professor Monica Moody. To me and an older sister, a mentor, really, and someone in sacred community. So thank you so much for being a part of our community. Thank you for journeying with us in this episode of Conscious Conversations. May something spoken here return to you when you most need it, gently, powerfully, as a reminder of your wholeness. If this conversation moved you, I'd love to hear from you. You can connect with us through montsiem.com. Until next time, stay present, stay tender, and remember, you are not alone in the work of transformation and liberation. Oh.